You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Wood.
And I'm Jennifer Connor.
From Equestrian Businesswomen, and you're listening to Equestrian B2B, the podcast that brings together industry leaders, entrepreneurs, and equestrians for conversations about how they build and sustain a successful business.
On today's show, we speak with sisters Meredith and Margot Sanger Katz about the thoughtful process they used to build a business during the pandemic, partnership agreements with family, and the importance of having fun.
Meredith Sanger Katz is a co-founder of Pinsnickety, a company that makes horse show number pins and charms with personality. She has worked in state government and real estate finance and has an MBA from Harvard Business School. She lives in New York with her husband and three-year-old twins who are almost ready for lead line. She competes in the amateur jumper division.
Margot Sanger Katz is a co-founder of Pinsnickety. She is also a longtime journalist who reports on healthcare policy in Washington, D.C. She grew up riding with her sister in New York and still competes in the amateur jumper division.
Hey, Equestrian B2B podcast listeners. Ready to level up your biz?
Ride Every Stride specializes in tailoring brand identities for equestrian businesses. From logo development, essential stable accessories, and custom product branding to exclusive awards, VIP event must-haves, and chic apparel, they've got you covered.
Visit RideEveryStride.com. Use code B2B15, that's B2B15, at checkout for an exclusive 15% discount.
Elevate your brand with Ride Every Stride, supporting women in business and equestrian excellence.
So excited to have both Meredith and Margot on today to talk a little bit about their business, Pinsnickety. And we're going to go ahead and jump right in. So Meredith, if you could kind of tell us which one of you came up with the idea.
Frankly, Margot came up with the idea first. She had seen magnets that people use on the back of their number, the four magnets at breed shows. And she thought, what a fabulous idea. Why is the hunter jumper world so boring and backwards? And so maybe I should let you tell Margot how it all came to be.
Yeah. So, I mean, this was actually kind of a long time ago, like probably almost 5 years before we launched the company. But I started thinking like, we could do something more fun. But I originally, and this is like why the partnership is so valuable, like I didn't think about a business. I just thought about a crafting project. So I saw this and I thought, oh, there's a version of this that could really work for our numbers in the jumper ring. And so I started just like making my own, you know, with like, you know, objects I was buying on Etsy and like gluing things together. And like, you know, they were like a little flimsy and they would break sometimes and they would fall off sometimes. But like, I thought that they were really cute. And I got a lot of really positive feedback from friends who saw them, who like immediately recognized, you know, safety pins are kind of lame. And if we're going to be
kind of
attaching, kind of lame, dangerous. I always like stabbing myself and they're always coming undone and like dangling around. And so this idea of having a number pin that was sort of like decorated and that showed some personality or matched the rest of your turnout, like I got just like a lot of good informal feedback from friends. And I ended up, you know, with my kind of crafting version of the product, making them for a lot of friends. And then, I don't know, life got busy and I put them in my tack trunk and I didn't have a horse to show for many years. And I didn't think about it again until during the COVID pandemic, where like two things happened that made me think about this idea again. One was Meredith was pregnant and let me borrow her wonderful horse. So I had the opportunity to show a really wonderful jumper for the first time in a long time. And so I went to go to my first horse show and I opened up my tack trunk with all my show stuff that I hadn't looked at. And like, there were these pins that I had made years before. And the other thing that happened is, and Meredith could talk more about this, is that she had been working on a business that just like wasn't a really good match for the pandemic economy. So she like had this break in her workflow where she had some availability to help me make this harebrained idea into a business. So I came to her and I said, you know, it seems like you have some downtime. I have this idea. I think if we could take this concept and make it into something really great, something that's really high quality and well-designed and unique, that this could be a new product that we could bring to market together.
Cool. That's awesome. So
I actually, years ago, just when they first started doing like the little bling on the spurs mm-hmm. for the spur straps, like I was like, oh, I could do that myself. And it's not nearly as easy as I thought it was going to be. I was like, no, it's way more worth it to pay for this and it be already done in a nice completed project than me having to like, they kept falling off. I had to keep replacing it.
Just yeah. And I mean, we can talk more about this later, but I think, you know, one thing for us was we wanted this product to be really good. And it seems like a really basic product. I mean, in some ways it is. It's just a pin. But there actually are like a ton of details in terms of the design and construction of the pins that we think are really crucial to making this a product that people want and can use easily and can count on. And like that stuff is actually, like you said, it's not easy. And it took us a long time. And it was, for me, like not having been in business before, I think it was a real learning experience just about, you know, product development and how it's a real process.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah.
I mean, that's something actually at Pinsnickety that we think about a lot and we care about a lot, which is sort of thoughtful product development and slow product development, which maybe is not always the best or the most efficient, but we really believe results in the best end product. I mean, we've frankly had products that we have considered launching that we have tested and tested and tested and redeveloped and redesigned and shelved because we just felt like you can't have a good user experience with this product the way it is now. And we try to be pretty meticulous about those details. And so when Margot came with this idea, I was like, well, we're not going to be gluing stuff to like pin bags that you found on Amazon. And by the way, there's people out there doing this kind of thing. And more mm-hmm. power to them. I wouldn't personally spend my money on that product because you're going to use it once or twice. It's going to fall off, like you said, with the spur straps, you know, leave it to the experts. And so we now consider ourselves experts. We spent a lot of time trying to figure it out and get it right. And I remember, it sounds silly, they sound simple, but I remember we prototyped these first sets of pins. I went to my first horse show. I was so excited to try them. I had them in my pocket. I went to go put them on the saddle pad up at the ring. They wouldn't go through the saddle pad. Then that's okay, no big deal. The next week I had a different prototype and I go to my horse show and I go to my saddle pad and I go to put it on. They go through the saddle pad. Great. I put this backing on that we thought was so thoughtful. You know, there were these rubber backings. We thought this is so great. It's soft. It's nice next to your horse's side. It's not going to irritate them. What a thoughtful, brilliant, you know, product design. And we put them on. I stick it through. The pin goes through the rubber backing directly into my horse's side. I'm just, oh, no. you know, the best laid plans. And I think that, you know, these things look simple, but you really have to design and test to get it right, to figure out what's really going to work. And I think that a shortcoming maybe of Margo and my partnership and of Pinsnickety is maybe that we're not always the fastest. And I think that is something that we need to work on and get better about. But I do think that everything we do is deliberate and thoughtfully tested and probably debated, you know, way too long, but hopefully to the right outcome. And anyway, the development of this, our signature product, is, I think, a pretty perfect example of that.
But this is not your main business or work, right? You guys have full-time jobs and do this on the side, or has Pinsnickety become your main work?
So for Margo, and she can talk a little bit about her career, this is something that she's doing on the side and that I'm sure I'm driving her employer crazy with all of my phone calls and, you know, texts and chats and so on. But for me, I've really taken this idea and run with it. I had a number of other entrepreneurial ventures that I was working on, but this has really taken the forefront. And so I'm more the day-to-day person on it. Yeah. But Margo, frankly, when we originally set this company up, you know, it was her idea, as I said earlier, and I sort of thought about, okay, how can we professionalize this? How can we make something that's going to last, that's high quality, that we can stand behind, that we can actually market? And Margo thought, well, this is a real fun project. You know, I'll get this off the ground with you. We'll spend some time on it.
We're in lockdown. Like, things are kind of boring right now. Like. Yeah.
And that Meredith, this will be your company. And, you know, she'll be a 10% partner. And that's what we decided. And we thought, well, that's great. We'll do that. And then, of course, we got to launch. And it turned out that Margot loves working with me and loved the business. And she couldn't get enough of it. And so instead of it really being my business.
So essential.
Essential. Critical.
You were an essential worker.
But the reality is that we did our original formation documents where I was the 90% partner and Margot was the 10% partner. And there was almost no expectation that Margot would be working on this in a real capacity beyond the launch. And we redid our formation documents to reflect our, you know, 50% partnership, because it's been so much fun. And it's been, frankly, so critical to have our different skill sets, our different perspectives to develop this business.
Yeah.
Do you guys have a partnership agreement between you?
We do. We felt like it was important to like sort of do everything in as professional a manner possible. So like our business is incorporated, it's registered, we have a partnership agreement. And we have, so Meredith still retains the majority stake. I think we're like 51-49 now. And so we felt, and we both agreed to this, that if there was some major dispute along the way, we didn't want to like have to get in like litigation about it or whatever. Exactly. We wanted to just like decide who is going to break the tie. But of course we're sisters and that's never going to happen. And so like, even though we have documents saying things, I mean, I think we really do view this as a 50-50 partnership.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's important though.
Yeah. I mean, even if you're not related, you know, a lot of friends go into business together and, you know, trouble in business can really test partnerships, and you have to outline from the start what your expectations are, right? And know, you know, how you're going to divide things up. And it's interesting to hear that you guys changed the formation of your company, because I don't think we've ever really talked about that with someone. And, you know, once they got into it, they noticed that it was unequal and changed it. So that's cool to hear that you guys did that. And so that other people can realize, hey, you know, I'm in this business and I'm doing way more than than we agreed on, so we should adjust this. And as far as kind of the day-to-day responsibilities, how do you split those up now?
So I do have a full-time job. I'm a journalist. I'm a reporter. And so like a lot of, you know, my work is somewhat flexible, but like in general, I'm working during the hours that like most people are working. And so I think that affected some of the way that we split things up, because there just are certain job tasks that like I just can't be on call during the workday. Not that I mean, every once in a while I can take a meeting, I can tape your podcast if I schedule it in advance. So I think that was one way that we split it up, is like I do a lot of the things that can be done in the evenings, on the weekends, you know, when I have a day off from work and can kind of catch up on stuff. But the other thing that we did to split things up, which I think just kind of made sense, was Meredith is like the actual business person in this business. You know, she has an MBA and she's worked in a number of different businesses before. And I think that there are just like certain core things in kind of finance, in manufacturing, in dealing with wholesale customers and doing sales that she has like is just right in her wheelhouse, and that she is just way better at me than and is maybe more interested in than me. Although I will say that it also turns out that Meredith is an amazing photographer, and I guess I'm theoretically like the creative, but I'm really bad photographer. So almost all of the amazing pictures that you see on our website and our social media, Meredith took those. And then like I do more of the marketing side of things. So kind of writing, you know, I make the website, I write all the captions for our social media posts, emails, our blog. And I do, we do work with a lot of horse shows in various capacities. And so I manage a lot of those relationships, because they tend to be a little bit less time sensitive than our communications with like, say, the manufacturer or with retail stores.
Yeah. And this is kind of a separate question, but we've talked to a lot of entrepreneurs who have started apparel businesses, and probably the biggest hurdle to them getting started was finding the right manufacturer and having to look worldwide for places that had quality, you know, whether they were up to standards for their employees, that sort of thing. Your product's obviously a lot different than clothing, but what was that process like finding someone to make these?
So I manage that part of the business. Mm-hmm. And again, I think maybe we did it a little bit more slowly than others would, but I think, to be honest, we really did it right. I had experience with manufacturing in other prior entrepreneurial ventures that I'd had. And frankly, I had a very challenging manufacturing experience that taught me a lot. What it really taught me was what not to do or what could happen in the worst possible case scenario every single time. And so I sort of went into this with eyes wide open and sort of freaked out about what could possibly go wrong. And so I felt like it was really important to talk to a lot of manufacturers at the same time, to talk to a lot of different kinds of manufacturers, to talk to manufacturers in different locations. That, you know, part of this prototyping process that we discussed earlier, that I wanted to sample from a lot of factories. And even if I wasn't moving forward with certain factories, that I felt like there was learning in that process. But, you know, there's also a cost to doing that, especially in our case, when you're bootstrapping the business. And so, you know, there's a push and pull. You can't just go out and work with 15 manufacturers and not care at all about any of them working out. I mean, you care, you want it to work out. But we really, really cared about quality. Margo thought I was completely insane because we would get these samples.
Flashbacks.
We would get these samples in and she'd be like, these look great. And it's not because she doesn't care and it's not because she doesn't have a close eye, but because they do look good. But I would inspect them under a light in every angle. And I would see on one pin at a certain angle at a certain time of day that there was a tiny speck of dust. And, you know, I was like, we can't use these guys, you know, and drove her absolutely insane. But I have to tell you, even now.
And you can see on our website now, we continue to have a product that is slightly imperfect pins, which, like, let me be honest, they are slightly imperfect. But if Meredith sees anything, any speck of dust on the pin, it's like we can't sell it for full price.
Cool. Well, that's at least you're not wasting them, and you can find a way to use them and acknowledge that they're not what you would normally sell at full price.
But what we learned is that different factories really do this really differently. Mm. There's different processes. They're based in different places. There's different language barriers. There's different timing. There's different cost structures. There are different material. I mean, all of these things. And we've sort of figured out what we like best and why. But we are still constantly always trying to go through manufacturers to find the best of the best. And we have our manufacturer that we've had from the very beginning, who we love, who we have a great relationship with, who does really high quality stuff. But we are always consistently testing out other places to have as a backup, you know, just so that you have different sources in case something happens with the supply chain or, you know. So again, it seems like it's a simple business. It's a small product. It doesn't seem like it's so intricate, but we really feel like it's important to be meticulous about the details and to have redundancies in our process so that, you know, you don't end up with bad product or bad user experience.
Right.
I do think, like, compared to an apparel manufacturer, we're kind of lucky because our product is not that expensive. And it's not, I think in particular, not that expensive to ship, actually turns out to be really important.
The weight and the size.
Yeah. So I think we were able to do a lot of sampling in ways that might be hard for different types of companies. You know, we were able to basically, you know, order from a bunch of different manufacturers, you know, 100 units of a product so that Meredith could do her insane process of, like, inspecting them all under a microscope and saying, oh, well, this one, you know, 10 of them had a speck of dust and this one 20. So I do think we're fortunate in that. And we knew that we were. And I think that allowed us to be even more insane and exacting in our standards because we really could compare. I think, you know, for companies that are doing apparel or doing very heavy products or very large products, I think it might be hard to do it quite the way that we did.
Right.
you know, I really didn't ever think about the manufacturing end of things, but being that I work for a pharmaceutical company, it can like make or break you in a product, mm-hmm. whether, you know, the inspections are done right or whether it's in a country that the FDA approves or not. And I had no idea about that until working in it. And so having a backup is such a good idea because you never know when you're going to have to shift. Somebody gets shut down for something that's not even completely related to your product. And then you're kind of up the creek. So I think that, you know, that's awesome that you guys have like this plan ahead and that you've been through it. And I also have to say that, you know, your experience, Meredith, of prior and having things go wrong, like I feel like sometimes that sets you up. So maybe that obviously wasn't intended to be what your business was, but maybe that experience gave you the experience for this to go forward.
And I think maybe one other piece of advice, and I, of course, learned this from Meredith and all of her previous challenges, is I think that she and us together like did a really good job of thinking hard in advance about all of the questions and all of the specifications that we needed from the manufacturer so that when we were talking to factories, you know, we could ask them this long list of questions that we needed to know the answers to all of them in advance. And we could compare them across different platforms. And then like, you know, when we were placing our orders, we really knew. And that is like another example of just, you know, something I think I've learned a lot from Meredith is just like, you kind of want to do your homework in advance. If you're just kind of like flying by the seat of your pants and you're like, oh, I'll get a sample, like we'll see from this manufacturer. And then, you know, it's not quite right or they're, you know, the pricing doesn't work or whatever, then you kind of like wasted time and money on it. And so that kind of advanced planning of like really just thinking through what are all the questions, what are all, you know, what are all the contingencies that you need to know about and asking it all in advance in a kind of organized way is ended up being a time saver in the end.
How long did it actually take from coming, you know, starting the business or coming up with the idea to, you know, coming to market and being able to sell?
I think it was about 6 months. And there were like other things that we did too. So there was this manufacturing process like that did take some time, but there was just like a lot of other stuff. Like we said, we had to incorporate the business and like do our business agreement. And we also spent a lot of time on design and branding because obviously like we're a design forward company. The whole thing about our pins is that they're like really cool and cute and they have a particular look. And we wanted, first of all, to have to launch the company with pin designs that we were really excited about, that we thought were a good collection that would put our best foot forward in terms of representing the kind of company that we were. But then we also wanted to have like a great brand name, you know, beautiful product packaging, like a really splashy website, lots of great photography. Yeah. And so all of that ended up taking some time.
Yeah, I didn't even think about packaging.
Oh, yes. We have thought a lot about packaging. We've talked about that for a while.
Did you guys go to any of those like packaging shows where you walk around and like you look at all the different people, vendors who have different packages?
No, but that sounds really fun.
Oh, I did it. I recently did it. I went to New York City and they have it. And you get to like meet all the people. You have to be a business, which you guys are. But I went with a publishing company and we walked around to look at like ideas for bags and books to package them. And it was really fun and pretty cool. And I had no idea that that was like a business, but apparently it is. So
we didn't go to any shows like that. But Margo and I have this thing that we do as a company that's a little weird. We call mini focus group. So whenever we're trying to make a decision about like what color card should this pin go on or like should we, you know, do the text like this or that, you know, it's usually some very small decision that probably will impact nobody, but to us is absolutely essential and critical. And we talk about it ad nauseum. We can't get to a decision or we're between two things and we mini focus group it. So I will reach out to a handful of my trusted advisors, friends from the barn, friends from business school, my mother-in-law, you know, people that have a good design eye or, you know, whatever the case may be. Margo does the same. And we send out these images, you know, this one or whatever the question may be. And we mini focus group it and it comes back and then we compare answers. And sometimes it's a simple majority wins, but sometimes, you know, by asking other people, you realize what you truly think. And so that has been a way that we have you know, it's not necessarily seeing all the packaging out at a show or something, but in terms of making those decisions, we sort of have our own board of advisors for these small decisions that we've really relied on. And we go back and talk about a lot how some of these decisions that we felt almost certain about and ready to move forward with at the beginning of the company, we mini focus grouped and someone had an idea and it completely changed our thinking. And we went with that idea. And now we literally say all the time, oh my gosh, can you believe that we were going to do X, Y, and Z? And now here we are doing this other thing. And it was such a fundamental decision that we love about our company now, and we would have gone down the wrong path. So right. I don't know. We really like this idea of mini focus grouping, and we really feel like you got to go out into the world and ask. You can't just look inwards. Sometimes you got to look outwards and let people, even if they're not in the business world, even if they're not an equestrian, you know, get someone's advice, and it can really help you make better decisions.
Yeah, so, I love that idea.
Yeah. And actually, I don't know, Jen, if you got this, but when I just did the fundraiser for Finley, the Do Good popcorn, they sent me like a survey to do. And it was pictures. It was just like that, where they're like, do you like this picture? Do you like this picture? Do you like this or this, this or this? And at the end of it, they asked, like, why did you pick what you picked? So then I like wrote out why I liked the, you know, one image over another. And I thought that was really kind of cool. I mean, it's a popcorn company, but I thought that was really like an interesting thing to do.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Huh.
Yeah. I really like that.
Yeah. And what was the very first design you came up with for the pins? I know you have like all sorts of cute ones.
I know. So I'm trying to think. So when we launched the company, we launched with 12 because we continue to think, and we thought at the beginning that like different people were going to want different things.
Yeah.
And like, that's the whole thing. We want it to be like, show your personality. Tell us about your horse. Tell us about how you're feeling today. Like, what class are you showing in? You know, we wanted there to be something for everyone and also something for every situation. So we initially launched with 12 and now we're up to like 35, which is kind of exciting. I don't know if I can think of like what the very first one that we did was, but we had this group. We started with a group. We had like a list of ideas. Oh yeah. Yeah. Meredith. we started with a list of ideas and then we like looked at a bunch of sketches and then we kind of got to our first 12 kind of as a group.
Did you have a designer make them or you guys found them? Like, how did you come up with the actual design?
So we did work with a designer. Meredith lives in Greenwich Village in New York, and she's very close to the new school where Parsons School of Design is. And so we were able to find a really great designer to work with us who we loved. And we've had a couple of designers who have helped us as well. But we, you know, it's important to us that like our products are not like some commodity thing that you can just like buy on Amazon or whatever. You know what I mean? These are all designs that like we really sweated and that are, you can't get anywhere else, and that they look like Pinsnickety. They have a Pinsnickety colors. They have a Pinsnickety style to them. And we also have thought about them a little bit as a collection. So like most people will just, you know, they like their horseshoes. They're going to use horseshoes on both sides of their number. But we do have people that like to mix and match them. And like, you know, we have ones that can kind of go together. Like our newest pin is, we have an avocado, but we also have a chili pepper pin. So we call that our guacamole mix and match set. You know, so there's people who mix them together. And so for that reason, also, we wanted them to feel coherent and like they could go together in these different combinations and still feel like they belonged as part of one set.
Mm-hmm.
That's really cool. So this kind of ties into like your marketing strategy and going forward with making more products and what have you. Can you kind of talk about that? Like you said, you launched 12 at first. Was that was always the intention? And, you know, where did that lead you for marketing?
So our intention was always to have a lot, but we were a startup, and, you know, especially for me, like I've never done a business before. Like, I don't know. And I think that really interesting thing about this business for us, and I think the thing that makes it different than probably some of the other people that you talk to, is we were kind of creating something from scratch that didn't exist in the market before. So like if we were releasing like a new pair of breeches, like in order for that to be successful, we would have to differentiate them from other breeches. There would be something special about our breeches. But I also think there would be like customer, you could show a picture of someone wearing the breeches and the customer would know what it is. And, you know, you would know how to describe it on your website, like what kind of search terms you were trying to get for Google, what the advertising looked like, who your partners might be, what stores to go to. And I think for us, like this idea of just like replacing a safety pin, which is like something that people don't even buy in tax stores and don't even really think about, with something really cool and awesome, it was like brand new. And so a lot of what we were doing at the beginning of the company was trying to explain that to people. And it was all different kinds of people. It was like our potential customers, it was stores, it was horse shows. And so, you know, we launched with 12. We always had this idea that we wanted to have a lot of them, but we like didn't know if it was going to work. And so we felt like 12 was enough where, first of all, just where our initial investment wasn't going to be like totally clear out our bank accounts if it failed. But it was also going to be enough where we felt like people were going to have choices and there was going to be enough variety that different kinds of customers were going to connect to them. And I think now, again, I think this was consistent with our strategy from the beginning to have a lot more, but I think it's easier now because people basically understand what the product is.
Right.
You know, people like now understand, and it's so fun for me to go to horse shows and be in the schooling area and see, you know, that like a lot of people are using them. So I do think now like we can be much more focused on like, what's the next design? What's the next concept? What's the next collection? A little bit less focused on like, how do we explain this product category from scratch to people?
Right. Yeah. And less get, education and more of the actual product.
And like we were talking about the product packaging before. And like, if you look at our product packaging, it has like a show number on it.
Yeah.
And that was like something we thought about a lot because we felt like if it was just like a piece of paper with some pins on it, it would look like jewelry. It would look, I think that, you know, a customer in a retail store that saw that product wouldn't necessarily know what it was and what it was for. And so we really wanted to have the product packaging to explain to you, no, like this is for your show number, put this on your show number.
Right.
And like similarly, like a lot of the photographs that we took at the beginning and that we used to promote the brand kind of all looked the same. They were just pictures of people's numbers on the saddle pad. And we talked about it a lot. We're like, oh, this is kind of boring. And it's like a little bit, you know, close up and, you know, it's not giving the context and the action of people riding and competing in the show arena and like how it fits in with like their whole look. But we felt like that kind of education was really important at the beginning, just to tell people like, this is the idea. This is what it's for. This is how you use it. We made a lot of like videos, like showing people how to put them on. But now over time, I think like we're kind of a little bit more past that. And so we get to do like a wider variety of fun stuff with the brand.
Cool.
Did you start marketing like direct to customer, or were you really trying to get into the businesses, into tax shops, or were you doing both?
We always felt like this should be a wholesale business and that we wanted to be a supplier to retailers. But we also realized two things. One, that it's really hard to break into tax stores, especially if you have a new product category, because you're not just saying, hey, buy our breeches, they're better for this reason that's innovative, but hey, you need this thing that literally hasn't existed that no one has ever needed before.
That you don't know how to merchandise, that you don't know how to sell to your customer.
Right.
Yeah. And so we felt like we had to have a direct-to-consumer business, and we felt like it was a way for us to do the marketing. We felt like, and we still feel like, the direct-to-consumer business helps us, it keeps us honest, it helps us market. We're in touch with our customers, we're getting feedback from them, they're sending us photos, they're telling us what they like, or they're asking for new shapes, or, you know, whatever the feedback is. I feel like it's really important to have a feedback loop to understand how your product is doing out in the world, to understand if there are any pain points or opportunities. And so we always saw it as a wholesale business, but we have felt that the DTC business is really integral to us being better at our job as wholesalers and being better at our job as marketers, because we feel like the marketing that we do, the social media that we do, the sponsorships, the outreach, all of that helps our retailers, you know, getting the brand out, getting, you know, sort of a grassroots customers coming to them and asking for the product. And so we really felt like having a part of that be direct to consumer was really important, even though, you know, we don't want to be competing with our retailers and we're not really trying to grow that piece of the business. It's more about having contact with our customers and having a feedback loop.
Yeah. Did the pandemic play any part in that of wanting to sell online?
I think we really got launched during the pandemic. Like we, in some ways, like the pandemic is the reason why this business existed, because like, you know, I was like a little bit bored because I was trapped at home and couldn't ride. And Meredith had this other business that was put on the sideline. So I think in that way, the pandemic was like absolutely critical to us developing this business. But I think the kind of mix of DTC and wholesale, I mean, we did have some conversations about it at the beginning, but I think we always felt like tax stores were really where we wanted to be. And that was going to be kind of our principal market. And then the DTC was kind of a wraparound and a way to support that and to supplement it. And also to be available to customers who didn't have a tax store in their area. And at the beginning of the company, like that was a lot of people. Like we were only in a couple of stores and a lot of those stores were concentrated in the Northeast. And I think increasingly over time, as we get more penetration across the US and hopefully into Canada, you know, people will come to us less and go to our stores more.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I find that like sometimes the going to the customer can help push it for sure. Like I, you know, sell pharmaceuticals. So a lot we sell to vets, that's our actual customer, but we do some marketing to, especially on very client friendly, horse owner friendly places, because we want to push the sales kind of up. Like they still have to go to their vet and ask for it, but you know, if they're not asking for it, then sometimes it falls to the wayside. So I completely understand that. I think that that's an important tool to be able to use at times, even if that's not your main focus, which like for my company, it's not. So
yeah. We've marketed to owners before, right?
Yeah.
Market to owners who then have to go and request it. So like you guys are marketing to riders who go to the tax stores and request it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It can be a useful tool for sure. And education too. Then you can educate the end user.
Right.
Meredith, in the beginning, in the beginning, I feel like we were really trying to pitch it to the tax shops and trying to explain what the product was and why they needed it. And, you know, some of them took flyers on us and some, you know, they liked the product, but it's just, it's hard to get them to commit a big chunk of change to try a new thing that they is unproven. They don't even know if it will work or if anyone will want it. And now we have tax shops coming to us and saying, our riders are asking for your product. Can we please carry your line? And that is so validating and just feels so great. You know, and there's still, we still do outreach. Don't misunderstand. I mean, we're reaching out to tax shops, we're marketing to them and so on. But I will say a big part of our business is tax stores coming to us because their customers are asking for it. And I think that comes from the direct marketing that we do. And frankly, people just seeing it at the shows and on the ground and wanting to have access to it themselves.
Right.
And I feel like then it works backwards too, where you can be support for the tax shops in the marketing area. So like for us, a lot of times we, you know, we have vet facing brochures and whatnot, but then we also will do client brochures for them so that they can sell the product. It's support for them.
And we've like thought about that a lot. I mean, we really want to be a good partner with our stores. And we know that they're like us. They're small business owners who like have a lot on their plates. And so like, I don't know, like things like we have like a Google Photos album with like our very best marketing photos. And we share that with all of our retailers so that we can say, if you want to put this on your website, if you want to use this on your social media, like here is a whole library of content that can allow you to market that you have our product. And we also have like done like, we like go around to all of our stores and take pictures of how they're merchandising it. And so we like share best practices, you know, with new stores. We say like, here are some different ways that like our most successful stores are putting the product in their store. We're always trying to think about how the lessons that we're learning from our own marketing or that we're learning from our existing stores can help support the new stores. Because, you know, those people who own tax stores, like that is a hard business. Like they are working really, really hard. And we want them to want to work with us.
That's great. That's a great idea about, you know, providing that content and that support. Because I think some business owners would just be like, you're lucky to have my awesome product. Not, you know,
we actually
want to, you know, help the stores sell it as well.
Yeah. So we actually have those that we can send to our veterinarians for them to upload onto their websites to give some digital content for them in case they need it for social media. And then that way also we have a little bit of control over what's getting put out there.
Yeah.
Which is helpful.
And obviously tax stores are geographically relevant, or at least the brick and mortar and mm-hmm. trailers are, right? I mean, it's not like people are necessarily shopping across the country, but we really try to be good partners and try to do marketing on behalf of our tax shops. So, mm-hmm. you know, if we do sponsorship at shows, we find out who all the vendors are going to be. If we have customers that are at that show, we always are telling people, go to this trailer, go to this store and shop Pinsnickety there. We're always trying to promote our partners whenever we can. We think we're pretty good on social media, and we try to use that to help our tax stores get their name out there and to, you know, be associated with our brand when that can help them.
Yeah. I think, you know, the rising tide lifts all boats saying works here as well, because the better they do, the better your products are going to sell as well, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's really important to us that they do well and that they are glad that they have us in their store. And the more they're selling the product, the more other people are seeing it in the store, the more people are seeing it in the schooling area, then the more people know about it. And it's definitely a virtuous cycle where I think, you know, the mm-hmm. people that follow us on social media, some of them are people that came to us because they came to us, but a lot of them are people who came to our product through a tax store, and then they're interested in our brand too. And so we can help support that whole ecosystem.
Yeah. And I saw on your website that in addition to the pins, you have charms now, which are super cute, and you have some accessories. You know, how did you make the decision to start adding products? And, you know, do you have plans to scale up or offer anything else? What's the vision for the company, if you want to share?
I feel like I'm talking too much. So, you know, we don't want to be the everything store, you know, like we make horse show number pins and like, but we do think that there are some opportunities for products that like fit in with what we do because they coordinate, because they're decorative in the same way, because they're design forward and like have personality in the way that our pins do. So the charms, I think, were kind of a natural extension of that. We actually had a customer really early on who said like, why don't you have charms? Like what I want is like everything to match. Yeah. And so we have developed this line of charms. I think there obviously are other people in the marketplace with charms. We think our charms are differentiated because, again, there are original designs. Like you cannot buy our charms anywhere else. We think they're higher quality. They're a little bit bigger than some of the like really cheap junky charms that, you know, you can see on Etsy and things like that. And they also have this Pinsnickety look of having this black outline and black hardware. And, you know, we have found like a lot of people want to buy matching sets. So they want to have their number pins and then they have a charm that they put on their horse's bonnet, that they put in a braid, that they put on a bridle. But then we have a lot of customers that are really just charm customers. Like they like our design, but they don't wear a number pin for whatever reason. Maybe they compete in the Hunter Ring, or maybe it's not a show product for them. It's something at home where, you know, their horse is the dragon. And so all of their tack has dragons on it instead of nameplates. So the charms have been fun because they feel connected to what we were already doing, but it's a little bit of a different product. And the customers are definitely overlapping, but not totally overlapping. So it's been a way that we've been able to appeal to more people. You know, some of the accessories are just like we wanted to have a way to store your pins. Like it's this small thing and they are kind of expensive and we don't want people to lose them in between shows. So we have experimented with that. We launched with a tiny little tack trunk, which we thought was really cute and we loved it, but we didn't feel they were high quality enough. A couple of them broke, not a lot, but enough that we thought, okay, we don't want to sell something that breaks. And so now what we have is a magnetic bowl that they stick to.
That's a great idea.
And people seem to really like that. And they're like, they're cute and they're fun. You could like shake them up. We make little videos for TikTok and stuff.
I've seen those for cocks, right? For horse cocks.
Yeah, it's a similar product to that. There are the ones that we make for the pins are a little smaller and they have our branding on them, but it's very similar concept. And I think you could probably put your cocks in there too if you wanted to.
let's get some Pinsnickety cocks. Little dimes going over the jump.
A little dragon on your cock. Yeah. I love it.
Have you run into any surprises in running the business? Is there anything that you can share that you've learned that surprised you?
Something that surprised me. I mean, everything surprises me. how well Margo and I work together is definitely a big surprise. No, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. But I mean, I guess one of the things that I think we both learned was, which we've talked a little bit about, is just sort of to sweat the small stuff. We just spent so much time fussing on these tiny details of like the product design, the photos to use, you know, what all of our posts on social media sort of have the same voice. And I can't tell you how many hours we've spent trying to decide these things. And maybe I'm just saying this is such a great idea and you should sweat the small stuff to make up for the fact that we're not the fastest company. But I really just think it's paid dividends. And it really has created this distinct brand identity that we keep going back to. And that is sort of the foundation of our company. The flip side of that, though, is that obsessing about every single detail can really bog you down and sort of paralyze you. And I am a person who is prone to being paralyzed by decisions, which is why my apartment is not decorated after, even though I've been here for 6 months and probably will never be decorated. Another thing that I think was really eye-opening and a big surprise about this business is how wonderful it is to have a partner. And so, you know, I joke about my sister. She's the older sister. You know, it's tough. You know, what she says goes. But the truth is that it has been so valuable, whether it's brainstorming, which, of course, the more minds, the better, or just really making a decision. And sometimes it's as simple as me saying, I want to do this thing, but I'm just not sure. There's this other option. And Margo just saying, this is so not important. I mean, just pick, you know, A. And her just saying she has confidence in decision A makes me have confidence in decision A. And we move forward. You know, sometimes it really is obsessing over it together and hearing a different perspective gets me there. And so having done a bunch of entrepreneurial things on my own before, I was surprised and delighted by how wonderful it is to have a partner to work with, to debate with, to argue with, to bounce ideas off of, to come up with ideas together. And I really feel like our decision making, which can be labored at times, is so much better because we have each other. And you asked earlier on the podcast, you know, is there sort of this division of labor? Who does what? And there is. There certainly are areas where I'm in charge of this, Margo's in charge of that. We have different expertise. We have different interests. We have different time, all of that. But there's a lot of stuff, and it's the strategy. It's the decision-making. It's, you know, that we do together. Where, frankly, a lot of the times, probably Margo could decide on her own, or I could do it on my own. I don't think anyone would be upset about that. But there's so much confidence in deciding together and feeling like we know this is the direction we want to go in. Yeah. And that really has surprised me. We just make better decisions together.
That's and cool. I think just to piggyback on this idea of partnership, I would say that I'm not even surprised by it anymore, but at the beginning, a really big surprise for me in doing this business was just the generosity of other people in this industry. Mm.
Yes.
You know, when we were just getting started and we were nobodies and no one knew who we were and no one understood anything about our product, you know, like I just cold called them.
Yeah.
And just said like, hey, I don't want to compete with you, but you know, I think I could learn from you. I love what you're doing. Like, will you give me some advice? And, you know, over the course of our life of this company, I've had those kinds of conversations with a lot of entrepreneurs in the equestrian space. And they're not all women, but they're mostly women. And they have just been so generous.
Yes.
So generous and so wise in a lot of cases. And I really feel, I know you guys are really acquainted with this as well because you work with all these women in business.
We have found we have the same experience.
Yeah. But I think, again, like I don't come from a business background. And I think I had this idea that it's like, you know, like really sharp elbows and like everyone's like fighting over the crumbs. And it's not like that at all. I think there's just a lot of warmth and generosity in this community. And I think there, you know, is a lot of recognition that we can kind of grow the pie together and like all succeed together.
So that's been a really nice surprise. I would say on the not so nice side, a big surprise for me is just how much work it is to run a business. You know, yes. Our business is not that complicated. It's not that big, but it still takes a lot of time. And yes. You know, my silly idea that I was going to just, you know, help for a couple of months and then, step back, was just obviously really foolish. And there's good things about that because it's been really fun and I like it and I've learned a lot, but, you know, running a business, I think, and taking it seriously and doing well is, it takes a lot of dedication and a lot of time.
For sure. Yeah, I love that. I mean, that's kind of why we started Equestrian Business Women, is we recognized that we, you know, within our industry of being able to go to people. And I mean, originally I went to friends and said, you know, I need help with this, or could you look at this for me? That weren't in a competing company, but it kind of grew from there and saying like, well, why can't we just start something that brings these people together and shares all of this experience and knowledge? So that's really cool that you've had that as well. And kind of confirms what we think.
Yeah.
What have you learned kind of throughout your time running the business and an overall lesson that you might be able to share?
I mean, an overall lesson, maybe this is too touchy-feely, but I think just like do what you like, do what makes you happy, do what brings you joy. You know, not everything in life has to be so serious. You know, I come from a pretty serious background in real estate, private equity. And, you know, the things you're buying are buildings. They're big. There's a lot of capital that goes into it. You know, it is sharp elbowed, you know, you're working nonstop from morning to night. You know, it's just, it's a lot of stress. It's a wonderful business that I love and that's interesting, but it's not a fun, joyful business, you know? And yeah. I just feel like Pinsnickety, at its core, what underlies it is just a fun, delightful product for a fun sport. I mean, it's a serious sport, but it's supposed to be fun. And I don't know, in my riding, I've had many moments. Maybe it's, you know, the horse wasn't right, or, you know, there was something wrong with me or the horse that maybe I didn't know at the time, or I was in the wrong division, or I was with the wrong trainer, or whatever. You know, this fun sport can be really stressful. It has a way of sucking the joy out of itself sometimes. And every once in a while, when you're at a horse show and you're so stressed out and you're, you know, don't talk to me, I'm about to go in the ring. I don't know where which is the seventh jump. Don't forget the seventh jump. That you just need to slow down for a second and just say, this is supposed to be fun. This is a hobby. This is a sport. I'm with this enormous, loving, warm animal and just want to have a good time. And look, business is serious. You have, as Margo said, it's a lot of work. You have to be focused. You have to be organized. But at the end of the day, do something joyful, do something fun, and don't take yourself too seriously. You know, even some of our pin shapes are designed just for that. I mean, one of the first pins that we launched in that initial 12 is a dumpster fire. And
it's like a cult favorite.
Yeah. I love it.
And it's not for everyone. Some people do not want that. And when we do show sponsorships, we do not give out the dumpster fire.
I need those just to put around my house.
You know, sometimes you wake up early and you spill coffee on your whites right before you go for your course walk. And that is a dumpster fire day. You know, you're going to win that class anyway. You know, you missed your course walk. You're covered in coffee. Whatever happens.
It's pouring rain. You're soaking wet. It's freezing cold.
Just don't take yourself too seriously, you know?
Yeah.
But then to say something serious.
Yeah.
I think for me, like a really big lesson is you can learn a lot. You know, I come from a completely different background. I've worked as a journalist for a really long time. And I do think that being a journalist helped with this, because a lot of what I do in my day-to-day work is try to learn about new things and explain them. But I do think, like, I didn't know anything about any of this business stuff. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know how to do marketing. I mean, come on. I didn't even really use social media that much before we did this. And I didn't know anything about SEO. I'd never built a website before. And like, I've learned a lot, you know? And I think that there's a lot of things that we do pretty well as a company that neither of us had ever done before we did it. Mm-hmm. And again, I think it speaks to Meredith's point that, like, maybe we were a little slow at the start. But I think we taught ourselves a lot, and we are operating a lot of parts of the business with a high level of competence, and we are not special unicorns. Like, I really think, like, practice makes perfect with, like, almost anything. And I think, if, you know, for people who want to do something they've never done before, or want to, you know, add a different capacity to their business, I think if you just kind of keep getting up and doing it and are sort of committed to learning, you really can learn a lot and can expand your skill set.
I love that. Yeah. The education component is something we talk about a lot as well. And, you know, adding to your skill set and, you know, maybe as you're learning things and as you're going through different parts of your business and you recognize, okay, I either hate this or I'm really bad at it, then you know what to outsource. And, you know, you can, and like Meredith said, like, find the joy in it and what you love to do, focus on those parts and get people to help you with the other parts. And
although sometimes I felt like sometimes the things that I thought I hated, it was just because I didn't know how to do them and it stressed me out.
Yeah.
And like, I just made myself do them for a little bit longer and got better at it. And then suddenly it became joyful. I was like, oh, I can do this. It's kind of fun, you know? And I proved myself wrong. Like, I can do this thing that I never could do before. I mean, I was talking to Meredith about this recently. I think I mentioned that she's such a great photographer. Mm-hmm. I don't know that that's something that she knew. And that is something that, like, we thought we were going to outsource at the beginning. And then it just turned out that, like, actually, like, you know, she has this amazing eye and it just keeps getting better with practice. And so I think there's a lot of stuff like that too. It's, of course, like, no one has enough hours in a day to do everything. And I think it does make sense to outsource things that really bring you no joy. But I would also say that you should, like, ask yourself why you don't like doing the thing. Yeah. Is it because you just aren't good at it yet? Or is it because it's just really not fun for you?
Yeah. You don't want to suck at something. That's how I am.
Also, I have something to add because I recently heard on a podcast they were talking about like a hack as saying that you can hire people to, like, teach you how to do some of these things. And I never even thought about that. And he was, like, really talking about, like, AI. Like, he knew nothing about AI. It frustrated him. He didn't know what to do. And he kept avoiding it. But he's an investor, so he really felt like he needed to learn about it. So he hired somebody to teach him every week. He has, like, 1 hour meeting with the guy. He asks his questions. The guy comes back to him the next week with the answers to the questions. And it's like an expert in AI, and he can explain things to him. And that's how he learned it. And I was like, oh, I would never think to, like, look for a tutor in some of these things. But, you know, I'm sure there's, like, Excel experts if you want to learn about Excel. Like, there's all these websites to find
bookkeeping.
Yeah. Yeah. So I thought that was interesting that that's available and you could do that if you really hate it, and then you can practice.
Great idea.
Yeah.
Well, I really enjoyed talking with both of you and learning more about you and the company. And at the end of each episode, we ask the same 4 questions, and Connor starts with the first.
Okay, Margo, I'm going to start with you. What is one action that women can take to make a big difference in their lives?
So I'm going to talk my own book here and say, read the news. I think it's really important to know what's going on in the world and be an informed person. And I think especially if you're working in the equestrian industry, it's just really easy to kind of get sucked into a little bubble and lose perspective on things.
And Meredith?
Amen.
Yeah. Meredith, well,
I don't want to repeat myself too much here, but I would say, just don't take yourself too seriously. Do what makes you happy and, you know, try to have a little bit of fun.
Great. And Meredith, what's the best habit that keeps you motivated personally?
This is going to seem kind of counterintuitive, but for me, honestly, it's getting to the barn and riding. I live in New York City, which is not exactly an equestrian paradise. I have to get in the car and drive an hour in each direction to ride. It's a massive time suck. It's expensive. It's exhausting. but I just feel like it's so good for my mental health. It just, you know, Meredith plus horse equals smiley face. And I just find that on days when I don't ride, I think, gosh, I'm going to have such a productive day. I'm going to start earlier. I'm going to get more done. And the truth is, I don't always succeed. Getting to the barn and just having some time for myself and being, you know, one with my animal, really, really makes me better at the other parts of my life. And so I really feel like it keeps me motivated. It keeps me focused. It keeps me happy. And it honestly keeps me productive.
Cool. And Margo, what's the best habit that keeps you motivated personally?
I guess it's sort of similar, but it's just exercise. I feel like it's just, there is nothing else that really clears your head and puts you in your body and like gives you a minute to just breathe and be away from all of the anxieties of normal life. And I think that is important.
Yeah.
And Margo, what's your favorite horse movie?
Oh, this is like an oldie, but a goodie, but I love National Velvet. It's such a great story. And I feel like it's also a story about, you know, a woman overcoming everyone's wrong expectations about what she can achieve.
For sure. Mm-hmm. And Meredith, how about you?
I have to admit, I haven't seen that many horse movies, if you can believe it. And so I don't know that this is my absolute favorite, but I have to say that I really liked Seabiscuit because I feel like, you know, on this podcast, among the four of us and with all of your listeners, we're all horse people, but it's this super niche world that nobody understands or knows anything about. And it's kind of fun to be transported to this moment in time when a horse was sort of the center of the universe and everybody was obsessed by with this one horse and by equestrian sport. And I just love that.
Cool. And I'm adding in a question here. Meredith, what's your favorite pin design?
Ooh, that is really hard.
It's like picking your favorite child.
It really is. And it's constantly changing. I would say that the dumpster fire is probably my favorite. I feel like it says a lot about us as a company, as individuals, and, you know, about, you know, having fun. I would say the pins that I probably use the most might be the lightning bolts, which I think are just like simple and beautiful and a lot of fun. I don't know. I got to say, I like a lot of them, which I guess is a good thing because we made them.
Right.
Margaret, do you have a favorite?
Well, I am very fond of the Queen Bee because my horse is named Bee and she is like a real mare. So that one makes me smile every time. I think that she's a really cute pin and it just fits with my horse. And I find myself reaching for that one a lot.
Oh my gosh. That's I might have to get that one because I have the Queen Bee Essex shirt.
Oh, yeah. Got that too. Yeah.
That'd be amazing. All matched.
And who would you guys recommend to be a future guest on the podcast?
So if it would be okay, could we both recommend the same person? Because we've been thinking about it a lot. And we were trying to think of someone who sort of like us came up with something that didn't really exist before. And so we want to recommend Catherine Winter, who owns this now chain of tack stores called Ride Equisafe. And she's a retailer. I think she does have some products of her own as well, but she like really specializes in safety equipment. And I think she did a really great job of sort of making herself the expert in safety equipment at the time when these safety vests were really becoming a much more mainstream part of the equestrian world. And she's built this incredible business that I think is impressive to us. I mean, she's such a nice and knowledgeable person, but I feel like the whole business is built on like her expertise and the fact that people really trust her judgment and that she is helping them stay safe. And we've enjoyed working with her a lot as a retailer as well.
Awesome. Well, thanks again for your time. And it was really fun talking with you.
Yeah. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having us. This has been great.
Such a pleasure.
Tired of searching multiple websites for equestrian products and services? Wish you could browse horses for sale and order supplements in one convenient place? Equivant was created by Horse Girls, who are dedicated to making it easy for fellow equestrians to find what they need for them and their horses.
Equivant partners with small equestrian businesses to advertise products, services, and horses for sale on one convenient marketplace. Shop on Equivant.com to find horses for sale, grooming products, supplements, riding apparel, trainers and vets in your area, and much more. They really do have everything you need for you and your horse.
I so enjoyed talking to both Meredith and Margo. I knew they were going to be amazing and fun guests. I love their company, Pinsnickety. I'm so glad it came across my Facebook feed and I was like, wait, what? And it's women owned? Let's get into this. So I called them, I sent them a message and asked if they'd be interested in being on the podcast. And we had like a great pre-interview chat, which was awesome. And they were just, they're so fun and so knowledgeable. And so like, I so enjoyed speaking to them.
I agree. I'd heard of the company and I knew what it was, but I didn't know the background of Margo and Meredith and, you know, how long it'd been in business or what they did before or any of that. So it was really interesting to hear, you know, that Meredith did have entrepreneurial experience and Margo had none. And I thought it was really cool to hear how they came together and built this business. And, you know, it's really become successful. And it's just really encouraging to hear stories like this. And they were just so fun to talk to. I loved their outlook on things, how easy they could explain, you know, what they went through, and just a lot of the really useful information I think they imparted just by telling us about what they did.
Yeah, I liked how they talked about doing it very slow and methodical, and also how they're very particular about the products. I think that, you know, sometimes people throw things together and are successful. And then I think there's other times where people who are a little bit slower at it, but bring quality to the table also are successful. So I think you can look at it both ways. I mean, recently I watched the masterclass of Sarah Blakely talking about making Spanx and, you know, she kind of like jumped right into it. Right. And
yeah,
she went right into manufacturing and walking around with a backpack. And so I think she kind of threw hers together, that she was doing it a little quicker than these ladies. But either way, I think it works out.
Yeah. And I love to see somebody care so much about the product that they're putting out, that they put that much time and effort into something that's like a pin that you use on your saddle pad, you know, like it's not a saddle. It's not something you're injecting into your horse or, you know, doesn't have dire consequences if you mess it up.
Right.
But they care. And, you know, those things are so important to them and they want it to look good. And all of that reflects back into a really quality product and, you know, something they can reliably manufacture. And in turn, because they've followed all of these self-imposed rules for quality and what they wanted, it comes through in the product, and then they can market it that way. And that, you know, all of their pins have the same look, you know, they have their own their own character, and that they can use to sell. And I just found it really cool to hear somebody talk about that and why it's so important to them. Because obviously, you know, if it were a life or death thing like medicine or something, then yeah, obviously you're going to test it and test it and test it. Right. And it just goes to show the passion that they have for business and being an entrepreneur and creating something that they love and that obviously lots of other people love as well.
Yeah. And I like that they recognized the direct to customer and how to get it going and giving education, especially on a product that nobody knew what it was or how to use it. And so I appreciate that they put so much time and thought into that and growing the business that way. And I think that that makes it for a successful business when you can kind of take both from the top down, like your tax stores and pitch to them, but then you've got your customers driving up from the bottom so that you can meet in the middle and kind of cover everybody. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like they recognize there are some people who are never going to use their pins, but they, you know, they might use their charms, and they recognize probably that there are people who are going to collect every single one because it's a cool thing. Like, I want to collect all of them because I just think it's a fun thing. And it's like a little, it's almost like a little secret community that you have going on. And then they're also kind of reaching the people in the middle who are like, maybe I need a set or two to show my personality. And so I like how, like, maybe in their marketing, they may not even realize, but they're really capturing like the whole market.
Yeah. Honestly, I want to get the dumpster fire pins and just put them on my backpack and like wear one on my shirt when I'm having a bad day.
I think, you know, there was another one that, another point that they made that I think is really important to bring up is like how accessible mentors are in the wine industry.
That was so cool to hear.
Yeah. And I never thought about that, but I think it is. I think it's just kind of like shooting your shot and reaching out to the people and getting feedback. And I think that the equine community is very open to it. There's not so many levels between us and the top level. I think we have access.
Absolutely. It's not like we're trying to, you know, go ask, it's a bad person to pick. I was going to say Elon Musk. But, you know, we're not trying to talk to the, you know, people that, like you said, are
building NASA space shuttles.
Yeah, it's not that. I mean, it's, you know, very successful people, but I do feel like our industry makes that type of situation possible where you can go up to people and and say, you know, I really like your product. Could I talk to you for, you know, a 30-minute call sometime? Or, and that's what we found, right? Anytime that we needed something or wanted to ask people questions, we just ask. And 9 times out of 10, they're more than willing to help. And it turns into a friendship or a partnership or, you know, just a connection that you can rely on, which is great to hear that Meredith and Margot have had that same experience.
Yeah. And I love Meredith's message about fun. If anybody follows my personal page, I always tag fun having because I'm a fun haver. And I have a really great story about this that isn't exactly related to the equine industry, but I think that it'll give everybody a laugh. My brother called me the other day and he was telling me that he was driving my nephew home from Boy Scouts with one of his friends, or Cub Scouts, I guess. And they're in the back seat. And my nephew turned to his friend and said, "Oh my gosh, I have the most funnest aunt ever." Said, "She is 100 fun." And my brother said to him, "I don't think there's a scale of fun. And so she can't be 100. And his friend piped in and said, "No, there is a scale. And 100 is the funnest, really, really fun." So the reason why I am the funnest aunt, though, is because he continued the story saying how when I threw him a poop party, which the poop party was because he learned to go to the potty, and I decided my mom had promised him a party, so I did all poop emojis for his party, like everything.
Oh my gosh.
And what I ended up doing also is getting a chocolate fountain, which I own. Which apparently is a huge flex when your aunt owns her very own chocolate fountain that you can put whatever you want in, like marshmallows and pretzels and cake and even fruit if you want. So I am the most fun. So I've decided that I'm pretty sure I'm making merch that say 100 fun on it.
No poop emoji merch.
I mean, we could put a poop emoji on it. Anyway, so yeah, that's my crazy story. So I'm 100 fun.
I love it.
And that's why I love Pinsnickety, because I think they are 100 fun.
Absolutely. I 100 agree. it's Friday. It's time to go have fun.
Yeah. I mean, fun havers. Here we go.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah. And with that, we're gonna end. And you can find the links to today's guests and the show notes at www.eqbusinesswomen.com. Equestrian B2B is out twice a month on the 1st and the 15th.
You can find out more at eqbusinesswomen.com and follow us on Facebook and Instagram. Find Equestrian B2B wherever you get your podcasts, and be sure to follow, subscribe, and leave a review so others can find us. You can have all 20 plus shows of the Horse Radio Network with you wherever you go with their free app for iPhone and Android. Go to your app store and search Horse Radio Network.
Now, go have fun.